Good evening, Mr. Tarver. How's it going?
Good evening. How are you? Doing great.
Well, we're down a man. There is no Jim. There is only Brad. Actually, there is no Jim. There's only Zool. Did you see the Ghostbusters that came out this summer?
I haven't. I couldn't decide if I really wanted to see it or not.
Spoiler alert. I can tell you, didn't really miss much. I took my nieces to see it. I thought it'd be cool for them to see something that had an all-female, you know, hero type thing. And it was okay. But I guess the critical thing was it just wasn't very funny.
It just seems like you can't get away with the same jokes that you tried to, you know, like 25 years or 30 years ago. Or it's just humor today just isn't as funny as it was back then. Maybe physical comedy is different. I'm not really sure what the difference is.
So what's going on in the world this week? So I hear that Bloomberg is reporting that Apple is building a Snapchat competitor. And the first thing that I thought was, didn't they learn anything from Ping? Right. This is one of those things where I don't really see the utility. What do you think about it?
Well, I can see where they're trying to go with what they've teased with iOS 10 and the Messenger app or Messages app. So I can see them trying to wrap everything into the Messages app, probably not going to make it a separate thing from, you know, like a separate video app from Messages. At the same time, they haven't ever done any sort of social media, social networking thing right, because Ping was a failure. And then the whole thing they wrapped into Apple Music really doesn't work. I mean, I guess you could follow your favorite artists on there, but nobody uses it. You can't get on there and follow Beyonce or somebody else that you may like, and they actually update that feed that, you know, is supposed to be there updated by your favorite artist.
If you think about it, there really hasn't been a social media upstart that has started inside of a well-established legacy company, right? You haven't seen anything popular come from like a Microsoft or an Apple or anything like that. It's always been some no-name company that, you know, starts small and then gets big. I don't think that a company is in a particular position to be able to launch something like that, mainly because there's a distrust around big companies having your data. It's look at Facebook. When Facebook started out, hey, it's this new little upstart. It's kind of cool. And then it gets to the point where they're collecting everything on me. I can't trust them. Same thing with Google. Nobody cares about Twitter, but still. I don't know. I don't see any established company being able to pull that off. And it just may be my viewpoint, but how do you think that would work? How do you think they would be able to be successful? Because I got some ideas on that.
Well, maybe, you know, how you would swipe left or swipe right, you know, and you're in the middle of texting somebody, or, you know, I don't know how they would pull off the 10-second video access or, you know, any other of the features that are built in, because now Snapchat has the news feeds from the different media corps, mail.co.uk and some other ones, Cosmopolitan or Vanity Fair. But I don't really see it being pulled off. It's kind of cool, and the concept of it is there. But I think the big companies, like you said, Microsoft, Apple, etc., they're just trying to keep relevance, whereas they're already relevant. I mean, they're making the stuff that we use every day to get to these other networks. I just don't see a need for it. I mean, let me use the texting and maybe put emojis in it, or use stickers and Telegram, but just leave the new social wheel to the new folks whenever they come up with the new idea.
Well, my thought was, with iMessage, they already have more probably average daily users than any other competitor out there anyway. So really, if they just build those effects into iMessage, you've captured what they've sold a billion iOS devices. Right there, you have a huge install base that would be almost comparable to Facebook or Instagram right there. The only thing that they're really missing at that point is the market that doesn't use Apple. I think if they took iMessage and they ported that to Android, they could pretty much do whatever they wanted at that point. I think that's one of the few things that I could see people on other platforms possibly adopting if they had features that were in there. You just couldn't call it like a social network type name, right? If you just said, hey, we're taking iMessage, we're rolling those same features into iMessage, and now it's available on all platforms, they boom, instant social network.
Right, but then you just call it a chat app if you're not trying to call it that. Call it a social network. You're just calling it the app name, which would be okay. People use Snapchat, and they don't say the Snapchat social network. They just say Snapchat, and they mean both the network and the app at the same time.
We also have to think about what the end game would be at that point. So for your average social network, the idea is I want to have as many users as possible because I want to push ads at them. Since Apple doesn't, iAd has never taken off. Everything they do is driven around hardware sales. You know, what would be the end game for them? you would have a lot of users on the platform that are buying your hardware, but if you make it available to users off the platform and it's not a subscription service, because we know that wouldn't work to drive revenue, how would they monetize something like that? I don't know that they necessarily would, but they would have a completely different business model than, say, Snapchat or Facebook or Instagram.
Yeah, I don't know what, like you said, I don't know what it would be in it for them unless there was a way to get people to switch because they think iMessage is so cool on Android. Well, you know, I'll go get an iPhone. It'll be even cooler. Who knows?
Well, the thing there is Apple Music is the only thing that I can think of that has made the jump to the other platform that's an official app. And it's a subscription app, so they really don't care where you consume it so long as, you know, you pay them money. So I don't see how, the more that I think about it, if you had something like iMessage, there would really be no incentive for you to move to Apple's platform, so I guess they wouldn't do it. But I mean, we already kind of treat it like a social network. You know, you'll see the memes pop up where, you know, you'll see the green bubbles appear on your phone and you just kind of turn your nose up at it as an Apple user. Like, why don't they have an iPhone? All the cool stuff that I do in iMessage doesn't work with these people. So, and I guess they kind of have a de facto one, but it seems like a weird thing. I can't see what the functionality, what benefit to them they would have by doing this. It doesn't solve something that isn't already been solved.
And at the same time, the new ideas come from the new companies. Let Apple do what they do best.
Not make social networks.
Right. Make hardware.
So something we talk about quite frequently on here is the streaming music services, much to Jim's chagrin. And I read this week that Pandora is actually aiming to compete with Spotify and Apple Music with a couple of new paid tiers. And my first thought was, Pandora's still around?
Yeah, it's hard to imagine them being relevant because that was probably the first streaming service I ever heard, music streaming service, beyond using, say, Icecast services that was a standalone radio type service. And that was probably the first thing I remember blocking in firewalls in corporate networks when I worked for corporate America.
Yeah. And the funny thing there is their business model has never approached what Spotify and iTunes have done until now, where they're actually allowing you to do sort of on-demand listening, right? Everything was radio. And I guess that was because the rates negotiated around music licensing are much better if you don't have the ability to select what you're going to listen to. I remember I used to use them a while ago, but it had fallen off and I haven't looked back. The thing that came to mind when I was thinking about that this week, though, is it's really, really awful to be a streaming music company. There was a great podcast I listened to a few years ago, and I really need to go back and look up where it was that I found this, but it talked to the CEO of this company, and the way that his negotiation was with the music industry was the more users he got, the more prohibitively expensive the royalties became, so the point that the more success you earned, you really would drive yourself out of business at a certain point. So it was really, you're pushing this rock up this hill, and at some point, if you reach this critical mass, it's going to crush you. We've already seen Spotify was going through problems this week where they're having to renegotiate their terms with the record companies, and Apple is paying, I guess, 3 cents more a user than they are. So now they're expected to pay that, and they're trying to fight it. And it's a tough thing. But I got to thinking about Netflix as a good obvious comparison point. Their big differentiator right now is that they're producing original content. And, you know, they made the comment in the past, we want to become HBO before HBO becomes us. And I got to thinking about that in terms of, you know, how would that apply to the music company? If I was going to run a streaming service, a music streaming service, what would I do to get around this? The only thing that I could think of would be to become a music label in the same way that Netflix has had to become a studio. The only way you're ever going to make that a winning proposition is to own the content. And I'm surprised we haven't seen that yet. What do you think about that?
That's a really interesting concept. I was kind of ahead of you in my brain as you start to say that. I was thinking, hey, that's a really cool thing that they should start, you know, they become their own music label. And then you said it. So that's probably the only way to keep your streaming music from imploding, apart from being someone like Apple who has $100 trillion in the bank. They're just ready to blow it 3 cents a pop on every song play.
Well, you have to think, too. You see that it's been announced that Apple Music is actually making a push into making, strangely enough, filmed content for that will be reportedly available to Apple Music subscribers. Now their iTunes concert they do every September is now where it used to be open to anyone with an iOS device. Now it's only those that pay for Apple Music subscription that they get access to it. You see the number of exclusives. Frank Ocean's album that just came out this past week was a iTunes exclusive. We've seen more and more things that are locked into iTunes for a period of time before showing up on other streaming services. I have a feeling it's just a matter of time. Maybe they don't go and become necessarily a TV studio. They keep denying that that's what they're trying to do, that they don't want to be a movie studio. But I could very well see them becoming a music studio in pretty short order.
I was just going to say that would be an additional stream of income for Apple.
You know, I say that that they may not become a TV studio, but again, if you go back to what we've talked about the last couple of weeks, how it came out that the TV execs have been very resistant to what they want to do, and they're like, we'll just wait. You're going to need us before we need you. I could still see very well they get into that the same game that Netflix is doing. They start bankrolling original content, and it gives them a better point to negotiate with. So
I see it as a way for them to raise their prices, though, if Apple did something like that, because I just got another email from Netflix saying that their subscription price is going up. I guess that should be reserved for another podcast, but I can see where that would become an issue.
Well, the other thing is, with like a $200 billion war chest, they could stand to play the game where they don't increase, say, the Apple Music subscriptions for a while, just to build up that user base, right? They have a lot of money to play with that they could really stick it to the record labels or to the TV studios if they really wanted to.
Well, they were certainly able to do it with that 3-month free Apple Music, you know, just to get everybody on board.
Yeah, originally they weren't paying the artists, but after, I guess, Taylor Swift had tweeted at Eddie Q, I think they went ahead and reversed course on that. So you still get the 3-month trial, but they're paying the artists for it now. So that's a great example. You have to do that. It's a sacrifice you have to make. You want to build up that all important user base.
Kind of like that radio ad I just heard on terrestrial radio for the web streaming of the P90X videos. They're doing some sort of promo right now on the radio, and it's similar to that, where you get a month or two free, and they say, you know, you could lose 30 pounds in a month for free.
Yeah, once you're in there, it's much harder to leave. So that's the new customer acquisitions for any company is always the toughest thing to get. Customer retention, a lot easier to maintain. Hey, if you've ever tried to call and cancel your cable, you'll know, hey, don't leave yet. I have a friend who's done satellite radio for, I don't know, a decade. And he's told me he's never paid full price, because at the end of every term, he calls, threatens to cancel. They give it to him 50% off for whatever period. And he just puts a note on his phone, remind me to call Sirius and renegotiate a better rate. And it seems to work.
You can't fight that, because satellite radio, I remember when it started, $8.95. And what is it now? $15.95 a month?
It's something ridiculous. I had it for a long time. I let it lapse, and then I looked at going back. Now, granted, they fixed a lot of things that I didn't like about it. You can now record shows. You can time shift them. They've become a lot more user friendly. But I used to do the same thing. Full disclosure, but I was also really seriously thinking about canceling when I would do that too, because I just didn't see the utility, and eventually I did get rid of it. But yeah, it's a ridiculous cost now. But yeah, I think it's at least 13 or 14 bucks a month.
What I never liked about it from the very beginning, and it may have gotten better since then, I haven't used satellite radio in a long time, was it always sounded like MP3, 128 MP3 in joint stereo. I could kind of hear that hiss where it was removing the center, you know, removing the left, right, and trying to mix into a center channel. And I just couldn't live with that. I just would rather put my headphones on my head and drive around with cans on my head than listen to that.
I could deal with the crappy audio. I just hated paying the money, and it touted itself as commercial free, and then that quickly seemed to go away pretty fast. So let's talk about the Amazon Echo. So you got one this week, and you're doing stuff with it. How's it going? How are you liking it? Do you regret the purchase? What's been going on with that?
I don't regret it. I just got it yesterday, so I haven't had a real long time to goof around and play with it. The first thing I did was hook it up to Spotify. Even though I have a Prime subscription, I could listen to Prime music, but I already have a lot of playlists and things built into Spotify. And then the second thing I did, to back up a little bit, I got an email, I don't know, a week or two ago from Honeywell saying that they are now integrated with Amazon Echo. Not to say that that was what was a catalyst to get me to buy it, but it was definitely a big help. And then watching Mr. Robot and the FBI, the redheaded FBI girl, always talking to hers in her apartment was another thing that kind of you know, raised my eyebrows toward it some. But I do have it, you know, integrated with my Honeywell thermostat now, and that's pretty neat. I do look forward to integrating it with, say, my garage door, or maybe putting a few smart lights in around the house.
Yeah, we got one around the office a few months ago when they first sent out the notice to Prime subscribers and saying, hey, you'll be the first one to get one of these. Put in your order now. And, you know, 3 months later, 4 months later, whatever, they finally get around to shipping it. So we did that and we got it in the office. And everyone I know that I hear talking about it online loves their Echo, love it to death. In the office, for us, in that particular setting, the novelty wore off pretty quickly. Of course, the employee who owns it went and disabled, so you couldn't place orders through it. So, you know, that's a given. We would have had real fun with that. But yeah, it hasn't been that great. So the Prime Music subscription that's built into it, half the time, you know, there's a lot of, we've talked extensively, so I won't go into it, but we've talked extensively about gaps in catalogs and on the multiple music services. There's a lot in the Prime catalog. And you'd say, hey, you know, Alexa, play this song. And it half the time you'd get like a live version, or you get a cover version, or you get a karaoke version. And we all just kind of looked at it like, you know. I mean, we would have fun with it and we would do some things with it, ask it what the weather was, so on and so forth. But, you know, I think in a home setting, I wouldn't feel so awkward about using it. I had considered getting the Echo Dot, the small, tiny one, and it sold out in July. There's no availability on when it's coming back. I really didn't care for what Amazon did. If you did want to order one of those, it was like, you have to order this from an Echo. Well, it turns out there was a nice little hack. You didn't. You could take the Amazon app and use the microphone feature in it, tell it to put it in your cart, and there it was. And then you could continue to order it from the app. I mean, I see what they were going for, but that seemed kind of silly to me. But I think I'm going to get one around the house. I really haven't gotten into the smart home thing. It's still sort of this balkanized, fractured state. And even though things are supposed to work well, I guess with iOS 10 coming out with a unified home app where you have all, you know, a single control panel for everything you own, I might be more inclined to do it. But whatever I buy, I would also want to integrate with Amazon, since there is no real, I guess you could use Siri in it to do the same thing, but it's not quite the same thing. It's not sitting there always listening and doing what you want it to do. But it's good to know that I look forward to seeing what you do with it over the next few weeks.
I think the nicest part about it so far was I plugged it in. It immediately found my Wi-Fi. You know, I opened the app, signed in with my Amazon credentials, and I had the thing set up in probably less than 2.5 minutes. And I had already integrated my thermostat with it in another less than a minute. And the interface for integrating all your smart home stuff is pretty simply laid out. So you could create groups so that you've got lights in groups or whatever, which I guess is the point of having the smart home. So you could flip a whole room on if you needed to, or I don't know, as far as a use concept for it, but it's really cool so far. I don't know what I'm going to do with it yet. Yeah, every time I read something else about it, kind of like the if this, then that sort of scenario, I'm kind of blown away with all the things you can do with it.
That's actually been it's good that you mentioned that. That's been the most enticing thing for me about buying one of these things is the IFTTT integrations. There are a ton of them, and Amazon has done a really good job at keeping that open enough. And enough developers seem to be jumping on board with enough smart home items that are working with it, that are compatible with it, that, you know, I had pretty much written this thing off as, it's just not for me. But I'm seriously considering it, though.
I mean, I realize a lot of the smart home stuff is sort of retrofit only because it's built your house, say, 10 years ago. Ooh, it's lightning. Or it's, you know, my house is older than I am. It's 42 years old. And as far as using the smart bulbs, you know, it's got to have the Wi-Fi built into the bulb, you know, the connectivity built into the bulb. It's not wired into every light socket around the house. But at the same time, it's no matter the amount of retrofitting, you can still bring in a level of, you know, that smart home without completely gutting your home to get there.
Yeah, it's true. And you can replace components as they wear out or as you just want that functionality. But this whole balkanized system really has to go. So for me, I do have some home automation things already. I have my garage door is, you know, controlled by an iOS app. I think I have the same thermostats that you do, the Honeywell thermostats that are controlled by its app. My home alarm system is controlled by an app. Unfortunately, though, it doesn't work. None of those things work with any other thing. is the problem. And you know that this is not some insurmountable problem, but none of them seem to want to address it. Like for the garage door, I go to the forums of the manufacturer's page and there's tons of people asking for it. And they're like, yes, in a future software update, we plan on doing something like this. And it's like, well, when, right? It's a chicken and the egg thing. And it's very frustrating because if there were things out there that I could buy that absolutely integrate with it, I would go get it. I would even retrofit in some cases, but it's, I don't know. Somebody needs to standardize on something. Somebody needs to get behind more one or the other. You know, I really need to look in to see if the Echo integrates with those components, because if they did, I would probably go and buy one right now just because I can't get that functionality out of my phone today.
I'm not going to say it does, but it probably does, just because I think that's what Apple was trying to do with HomeKit and iOS, was give you a single API interface to interact with all these other brands of things, because they all have their own way of doing flipping the light on or off. And the same goes with Amazon. It's just, instead of telling you that we've got this API kit that you can write your own apps for, they've just gone ahead and wrapped it into what they're giving you. So they've got a sort of a turnkey product for the consumer to go and add all of their devices that they may already have in their house, be it the thermostat or the garage door. And the Ryobi has a new garage door opener that's modular. So you can add a Wi-Fi component to it and then install a Ryobi app on your Android or iOS device. And it's got some other things like the extension cord on a reel and other things, but you can add about 8 or 9 different components to your garage door opener. And I guess it just acts as a sort of a daisy chain to the 110 outlet that's in the roof or in the ceiling of your garage.
Interesting. I'll have to look at that. Though I did just replace my garage door with this unit that, again, was like, I think it was like 2 years ago this month that I did it. And, I like it a lot, right? I can use the app. I can tell how long it's been closed. I can see the history of it. I get an email every time someone opens or closes it. So I like it. It's just, why? I know they can do it. That's the thing that's frustrating. And they just haven't. So it kind of sucks, but I think it's going to come around. So let's talk about, since Jim's not here, since you and I are probably two of the bigger geeks, let's gear off into something geeky. So you've been reading about this Fuchsia OS from Google. What do you know about it?
It's sort of vaporware to me so far, just because I haven't been able to put my hands on it. But the concept of it is cool. The fact that they're going to sort of wrap Chrome OS and Android into one thing. I can see the potentials for some really cool smartphone or smart devices or Internet of Things type devices that you would plan all around your life. And I guess it goes along with the smart home stuff too.
So when I was doing my homework for this episode, doing my required mandatory reading, I decided to really sort of dig into it. And I didn't play with it. I looked at the project on GitHub. I read up on the Magenta microkernel, which it's based. I thought it was a little strange that, with Chrome OS and Android both being based on Linux, this was something that's not. And it's kind of weird to me because Linux runs on everything. I mean, it can go anywhere. And I thought, well, why would they be doing this? What's this about? And so digging more into the Magenta microkernel, it looks like the first thing, and you mentioned it, Internet of Things is what this seems really geared for. So, I guess the OS that your toaster is going to end up running at some point is probably going to be based on something similar to this. So written in Dart and in C, which Dart also fascinates me too, but I haven't spent a lot of time with that. Since these microkernels typically run on embedded systems, I'm guessing, hey, my next garage door may end up running Fuchsia, I think.
Yeah, I kind of see it. I know that Raspberry Pi can run both Linux and a very trimmed down version of Windows. I kind of see it in that type scenario where it would be a little add-on device that you would tack on to the back of something, to give it the Internet of Things capability to where it plugs into your life.
Yeah, that's the other thing too. With the stuff that Google does, it typically, they're having to think beyond a single hardware set that they define. So things like, you take something like Android, it's going to run on kind of like Linux itself. It has to run on a ton of different devices. Compare that to the Apple way of doing things, where they control the hardware completely, and maybe it's not so important to them because they're going to control everything at the driver level. They know every single component that's going to go in there. They don't have to build anything that's going to, account for scenarios they didn't plan on. So it's weird. It's always good to watch, you see the two approaches. and see which one ends up dominating. So along the lines of other geeky topics, let's talk about the hard drive utility that came out this past couple of weeks, the hard drive manager from Paragon Software. So it turns out we were both going to talk about this, and I thought we were both reviewing it. Turns out we both bought it and didn't tell the other. So have you played with it at all? Have you seen some of the neat capabilities that it has?
I haven't used the snapshot capability, but you know, I was really miffed whenever you see what disk utility turned into whenever LCAP came out. And I do like that it's got kind of a cleaner, more friendly GUI than what disk utility did before. It looks a lot like if you ever use Gpart or Gpart-ed on Linux to manage your partitions. Another thing is, since LCAP has come out, I've gotten really comfortable with formatting and doing things inside of the terminal. And now it gives back that GUI, you know, ability to me, and I'll be able to tell someone how to format or manage their storage in some way through a GUI instead of saying, well, open your terminal first.
Yeah, I thought it was strange how they seemingly kneecapped disk utility in the latest release. That whenever you take functionality out, that's the thing that I have a hard time dealing with. And I really do like the snapshot feature. So having an exact sector level copy of the OS and all of your user data is pretty slick. And for $40, it's actually not a bad deal to have a utility that can do something like that, because that's the one thing that people don't do enough is back up their data. And having it in such a way that it creates a more efficient backup, and it does it a lot quicker than, say, something like Time Machine. Time Machine still has the the set it and forget it advantage that's going on, but I really do dig the snapshot feature. That was the determining factor for me. I really missed having disk utility, but seeing the things that it could do from a snapshot perspective, it sealed the deal. It's like, for $40, I gotta have it.
It didn't hurt that it's a Paragon product. I've been a big fan of Paragon NTFS forever. I mean, 10 years at least.
Yeah, Paragon, for me, that goes back to the early 2000s, back when I was much more of a Linux on the desktop guy way, way back then. And being able, I think they actually made the NTFS product for Linux as well, the commercial one you could buy. Obviously, you know, you had the drivers, the experimental stuff you could do. But if you wanted a commercial utility, if you wanted to be able to do HFS plus volumes on Linux, if you wanted to have something that was in a nice prepackaged way that had a little bit of support behind it, it was a good product. So I used to buy I also bought the EXTFS modules they had back in the day for Windows, so I could take my Linux drives and, you know, work on them on the few Windows machines that I had. So they've made good products for a long time. I mean, it's one of those, some of those vendors you deal with for a long time, they make quality products. I really wish that they had something like Disk Warrior, I guess, was the, Disk Warrior is a great product too. It's like a $100 thing. And if you've ever had drives die in the past, you've tried to recover things off. Of course, that was with spinning disks, and that's really going away. That's really becoming more of a thing of the past. But, you know, stuff like that really saved my bacon back in the day. And I really wish that kind of functionality was sort of built in, but, you know, as a tool, I guess for $40, it's really not a bad deal. I don't know if it's just a sale price that they plan on raising later, but I'm glad I jumped on it when I did.
Yeah, same here. I'm glad I was an early adopter, if you will.
Continuing the geeking out theme, so it looks like folks that were digging through the Sierra code for macOS found references to Thunderbolt 3 and 10 gigabit a second USB 3.1 transfer speeds in future Macs. So I'm hoping that means that we have a hardware refresh coming up.
Yeah, that's pretty exciting stuff. It makes me happy to know that we still have those people who are that curious to dig into code to find that stuff. I just bought something the other day that was USB 3.1, and it was a thumb drive, and I was surprised to see that already. You know, I didn't realize that USB 3.1 had been around that long already.
I had a similar situation where I bought a thumb drive that was USB 3.1, and I don't pay attention to it all that often. The thing that I find more intriguing is the Thunderbolt 3. So are you using any Thunderbolt devices on your Mac today?
I'm not.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's still kind of a rarity outside of the Apple world, even though it's an Intel technology. You don't find a lot of folks that are actually supporting it, unfortunately, which is actually really cool. I have a couple of Thunderbolt devices that I use. So my monitor connects via Thunderbolt, and my Drobo 5D also connects over Thunderbolt. But again, those are older versions of Thunderbolt in both cases. So the thing that's kind of neat, and I'm just doing a quick read of the Thunderbolt 3 spec as we're talking, is the ability to drive, I guess, 4K displays is one of the things that I think Thunderbolt 3 looks like it has going for it that the previous versions don't. And I know that's been a big frustration for Mac users. That was sort of a limiting factor. So maybe you'll see Mac Pros that are capable of driving 4K or 5K displays for the ones that are doing Thunderbolt 3. But the thing that I like most about Thunderbolt, and I know you can do this with other technologies, is when my monitor, when my MacBook Pro is connected to my monitor via Thunderbolt, every device that connects to my monitor is also seen by the MacBook Pro. So I can plug USB devices or any other device directly into the monitor, and everything, my network connection, everything travels over Thunderbolt, which is a one cable to plug in when you sit down to dock your Mac. So that's kind of neat.
It's very cool technology. Every time I get ready to buy another peripheral, I think I need to, you know, get a Thunderbolt dock so that I can plug more stuff into it.
Well, they're prohibitively expensive too, is a problem. That's kept me from actually getting an actual dock. But you know, the MacBook Pro has two Lightning ports, so it's usually more than enough for what I need. But each one of those docks are like $200 a piece or something ridiculous. And it's kind of crazy. Though I guess you could make the argument, if they do end up adopting USB-C widely, as they've done with their regular MacBook, that you're going to need a hub or something similar anyway. So I have a feeling that those docks are going to become a little more popular. So did you see this week there was an article that I guess a couple of years ago, Siri started using neural networking to actually increase its machine learning. Did you read that article?
I got through about half of it. What was funny was the title of it was something about iBrain, and I read it at first as iBrian.
I would totally buy that device.
It was interesting though to know not so much that they sort of left it in a kind of like the wizard behind the curtain. You know, they didn't really say, oh, we're adding machine learning, but then people saw that it stopped being as crappy as it was, you know, as far as interpreting the things that you're saying.
Yeah, and that was, you know, when iOS 10 comes out and we really get to see if there's going to be a difference with the differential privacy that is still sort of, as it mentions in the article, is kind of a mind bender in how it works anyway. I really want to see how much better it gets, because I got to call BS on what they're saying. I mean, I realize that we've seen examples of this, like show me an 80s movie with Matthew Broderick or something, and it'll go and on the Apple TV and actually find those, right? And you don't have to phrase it necessarily a certain way, though we talked about the Hey Siri cheat sheet, which is actually pretty cool too. The learning may have gotten better, but there are still so many times that it's actually brain dead that it's killing me. The other day, I had several doctor's visits I was knocking out this week. You know, I open up Siri, I say, navigate to this place, and I say it very clearly. I don't think that anyone who would listen to this would say that I can't speak clearly. And it got it wrong, and it got it wrong in three different ways, three different times. I was about ready to whip my phone out the window till I finally just said, screw it, opened up Waze, and Waze I had already used the previous time, so it knew where the thing was. But they're saying that part of the reason that Siri has a bad experience is because of the quality of microphones in iOS and Apple Watches. They're saying that the mics haven't been upgraded since, I think, the iPhone 5. Did you see that?
I did see that, and it's a surprising thing to me that Apple would... It's got the best camera, it's got the best this, the best display. You know, you hear Etta Q saying it's got the best of this, and yet it's got a crap mic in it.
You can always tell what they're the most proud of by what they spend the most time on and the product launches. So again, the camera and again, a lot of that is software more so than hardware, but still, you know, they always tout that, but you know, come to think of it, they've never had any mention of, and I guess it seems like it's a weird feature that they would tout. Hey, we've got a great microphone. Most of the time it works pretty well, I'd say. Half the time, you know, if I'm sitting in a restaurant and music's playing, I can pick up my phone and go, you know, what song is this? And it will listen and correctly identify it. And that has ambient noise in it. That has conversations going on. That has all these other things. Yet I can be sitting in my car with all the windows rolled up, not moving or moving very, very slowly, tell it where to go, And it's comically bad at how it's able to interpret these things, whereas you know that the Google app necessarily wouldn't do that, or Waze wouldn't do that. So very strange. I hope that's something that gets fixed. But I did find the neural networking article important, and it says what a lot of people are thinking too, right? It says that, you know, Apple is so secretive, we don't know, you know, what name the big people that are working in AI that are working for Apple. And most of them work for Facebook or Google. So this will be interesting to see what the actual practical results that turn up after iOS 10 come out. But I'm still kind of like, I'm not really holding my breath for that one.
Yeah, back to the microphone thing. There was, you know, the announcement, I guess it was around the iPhone 5 or even the 5S, where they said, oh, we put a second mic on it. And I guess that was just to, you know, work around noise reduction. But, you know, I think putting a single really good mic in there may prevent you from having to put in two mics.
The other thing, too, for voice recognition, I mean, since they are making a big push into privacy, they're not getting, I don't think, maybe I'm wrong, who knows. I wonder if they're getting the aggregate results of everybody searching for things, the way that people ask for things. You know, is that getting back to them? Is it helping them tune those searches? Is it really getting smarter? That's what a neural network is supposed to do. And allegedly, one of the examples in there is like you could say, you know, send my wife $25 through the Cash App and it would do it. Or you could say, shoot my wife $25 and it would intuitively know what that meant. So I see that, and it seems like science fiction to me, to someone who uses Siri on a regular basis, because it's, I mean, sometimes it'll do it, sometimes it won't. I can, you know, press the button and say, you know, hey, text my wife, and it'll know what to do. But other times I'll tell it to go to a place that we've been before, and it just, it's horrible. Like, it's really hard to rely on sometimes. So let's talk about Read It Later services. So it was announced this week that Pinterest bought Instapaper from BetaWorks, venerable Instapaper that's been around since, what, 2008? So are you using Instapaper, Brad?
I used Instapaper a long time ago, you know, probably 2009, 2010, something like that. And I didn't find that I used it enough to really keep using it. I'm using Get Pocket now, or Pocket, whatever you want to call it. It allows me to just stick a link in there and I can go back and recall the link. It lets me pull up the link, and I guess I could read it from within the Pocket website, but I usually just go straight back to the original content.
Yeah, that sort of mirrors exactly my use. I used to use Instapaper back when it was still owned by Marco Arment long ago. And I guess I had moved away from it by the time that BetaWorks acquired Instapaper from Marco. And again, I moved to Pocket as well, and I've been happy with it. I think my motivation for doing it at the time was I had heard that it was able to capture media that Instapaper didn't, which I've, you know, in retrospect, it's never been the case, at least not for me. But it was supposed to be able to capture like audio and video too, I thought, or something like that. If you put a link in there, it was supposed to be able to cache it. But I've never had that experience. And, you know, once I had moved to it, I just moved to it. So I think it seems kind of a weird acquisition for Pinterest to make. I can't imagine there's a lot of interest in that space, simply because if you look at the competition from an OS level, you have Read It Later that's built into to iOS, which is probably where I put most of my things that I go for Read For Later, probably on my iPhone or iPad. So you have that built into the OS. That's gonna take a chunk away from it. Facebook actually has a pretty decent Read It Later service built into it. If you use the official app at all, you ever try to read something, you're given an option to read it later. And I used it like maybe once or twice just to see how it worked. And all the content, both articles are both still there months later. So just so many places are doing it, and it's built into so many things that people already consume content from. It just seems sort of a weird thing for them to have any interest in at all.
What I hope to see in iOS, and you know, this is probably pie in the sky, but you've already got Facebook and Twitter and Vimeo and built in, you know, the sort of single sign-on. I imagine that one day we'll see Pinterest and some others, even Snapchat, get rolled in to the sort of single sign-on functionality, so that you could send something to Pinterest or send it to, but all that's available now through the share sheet anyway, through extensions and the share sheet.
Yeah, that's exactly how I use it for most of the stuff that I do, is all through the share sheet. And sometimes when the application level integrations don't seem to work as well as using the share sheet. So I'll give you an example for me. You know, I get emails from Medium and some of the other news groups, apps that I, or websites that I subscribe to and get digested email. And things will come through. I'll see something that I want to read. Let's say I'm using Spark on the iPhone or the iPad and I want to save it for later. There's actually a native integration inside of Spark to go and do it. And, you know, I love Spark. I love the Readle guys. They're great. But the integration, whether it's, you know, a limitation on Pocket side or maybe the way iOS handles it, it's kind of clumsy. It's not really what I would expect from that app that's so polished in every other way. When you try to save to Pocket, it's just not that great of an experience. However, if you just sort of like right click, you hold down a link inside of iOS, it'll pop up the share sheet, you hit Pocket, and boom, 1 second later, it's saved. I think the thing that surprised me most about Pocket, I got a notification. I thought this was just, they say this to everybody. It was like, you're in our top 5% of people who save things into Pocket. And I thought, wow, I save a lot. Then my next thought was, wow, there must not be a lot of users if I'm in the top percent. But I do save a lot of articles to Pocket. Pocket is great when you don't want to pay for Wi-Fi on a plane, or you're waiting in line at a doctor's office or some other place where you're going to be a while. So that's typically my use case for that.
I wonder if maybe Pinterest is going to use some sort of IP that Instapaper has, like news aggregation or something, and try to wrap it into their already very popular stuff. I mean, I think other than Facebook, Pinterest is probably the one website that my wife goes to.
Yeah, the ability to screen scrape or whatever it was that you want to call that Instapaper had and Get Pocket uses, that actually really was good. I mean, I know back in the Marco days, it was actually really reliable. When you wanted to save something, it did a pretty good job of being able to do it. Nothing's more frustrating than trying to save something to Pocket. You think you've saved it, you go back, you're sitting there, you have no internet, or you're on a plane or something, you go to load it up and it got some like, visit this website instead of catching the content. Right, where you don't have the option to switch to the web view, it's kind of bad. So maybe there was some capabilities in the code that made it an interesting acquisition. I can't imagine it had that many users though. So it is kind of a quirky purchase. So let's talk about, let's see what's happened this week. So Twitter. We both are pretty prolific on Twitter. It looks like they have a night mode now in their official iOS app. I guess the Android apps had it for a while. It just finally came to iOS. So on your Twitter use, do you use the official client or do you use a third party?
I actually use Tweetbot on Mac, but I use the official Twitter client on my phone. Not real sure why, I just seem to. I like the, it seems to update or notify me more on the official Twitter app than it does on Tweetbot. And maybe I've just toggled something off on Tweetbot and don't realize it. I do like that it has the night mode now. I mean, every app that I use that has night mode, I always put it into night mode, be it Reddit or some podcast app that I use.
Yeah, that I can see that. So, you know, one of the things you probably have to consider there with the notification part is, of course, Twitter is notorious about handicapping the API. So the third-party clients don't get the exact same functionality that the official Twitter app has. They're getting a little bit better, but it's really sort of weird, the arbitrary things they put in there, right? They had the API. They capped the number of tokens that developers could use. You know, they make it so cumbersome because they want to control the experience. And the funny thing is, I think part of the reason Twitter had, they got so many users, and of course not so many anymore, but was because they had the ability. They had this open platform that people were developing for. I really like Tweetbot. I use it on all the platforms. I really like that more than the official Twitter app. When I go and I use the Twitter app, because I do have it installed, I always wonder, it's like, how do people tolerate this? This is so, the UI is just not, it's just not pretty. It's just not, it's not good. I don't like the lack of chronological tweets anymore by default when they have the while you were away. And it's not while you're away from Twitter, it's while you're away from the Twitter app. So if I don't use the Twitter app for a while, but I go into it, I'll see things from like 3 or 4 weeks ago. And it's like, I've seen all of this. I'm using this third-party client. I see it, which is kind of bad. And going back to that whole crippling through the API, they held out features like the ability to send images through direct messages. And this is the worst thing. So I'm at a conference a couple of months ago in Vegas. The only way that I had to communicate with somebody that I used to work with was through their Twitter handle. So, you know, they're like, hey, where are you? And I say, I'm over by this escalator and I want to send a picture. Well, I can't do that through Tweetbot, so I have to fire it up over in the official Twitter app, send the picture through a DM that way, then flip back to the third-party app. And guess what? I can see the picture in the third-party app. There's just no mechanism for me to send it. They didn't support animated GIFs. It was just a whole thing. It was just the crippling that they've done. It's nonsensical. So I really, really can't stand the official app. Now, I do keep it around. If I click on a link inside of a web page or something on iOS, it'll open the official app, whereas it used to just open the mobile website. But I've never really liked it going back to, do you remember the Dick Bar? Do you remember that?
I'm afraid I don't.
So we can still mark this podcast as clean, because what I'm talking about is it was a bar. It was a nickname given to the ad bar that would pop up inside of the Twitter app, named after the then CEO, Dick Costolo, where, you know, these ads would just obtrusively pop up into the feed while you were looking at it. The user response to it was so terrible, they finally removed it. And, you know, they're doing the promoted tweets and things now, which seems like, I guess, the best way for them to do it. But it's always just been just this crappy UI, in my opinion. So I'm glad they got the night mode, at least when it does open accidentally, or the limited use case where I have it, it doesn't look like this just pure white monstrosity anymore, but doesn't matter too much to me, but I'm glad they did it. So Apple acquired a startup called Glimpse with two eyes in it, and no one's really sure what the plan is, but apparently Glimpse was a company that was serious about being able to take all of your health statistics from various sources and put them into some sort of a single clearinghouse for you to be able to look at maybe all the lab results you've ever had, or all the doctor's visits you've had, or, you know, being able to track your overall health. And it really looks like that Apple, between this and the things they've done with the Apple Watch, are really serious about people improving their health. So what do you think's in it for Apple?
I think it's just more integration. You know, they're either buying up competition, which is typical, or they are going to take their code and wrap it into something that they already have, you know, based in HealthKit or the health app that they already have out there, you know, just trying to add more functionality to it.
Yeah, the thing that came to mind for me when I was reading this is, you know, one of the things that we just mentioned, how Apple seems to get dinged in the AI space because, you know, they don't seem to be taking the aggregate of all their user data and being able to mine it for things and take the results of that and build smarter AI. Well, the thing about the health data, again, it's very private. Most people don't want that shared. Most people, you know, it's one of those things where there's very strict laws around it. It's a perfect use case for being able to have data that's not mined, that's very personal. And, you know, they're saying they're doing all of their analysis on device. So by having that, as much of that data in one place, that place being your phone, this is a place where they could actually show off some of that machine learning and show off, you know, hey, your blood sugar was at this level for the last 3 weeks. Maybe consider doing this. Or, you know, it looks like you weren't getting enough sleep based off of what we see on your Apple Watch. So maybe you want to look at getting a CPAP or something like that. Great way, I think, for them to actually be able to show the benefits of the AI that they actually already have without necessarily having to have data that would be useful in aggregate, if that makes sense.
You know, there really is a easy way for them to plug into all this, and supposedly all of your providers are, if they're going to stay relevant, they're all supposed to have these electronic medical record systems that all talk in the same stream, which is HL7, and they're all supposed to make it available to you, the patient. You know, I don't see why, you know, they couldn't pull all that in now, unless it's just a matter of more privacy red tape.
Yeah, I'm sure HIPAA probably doesn't make that easy. Though I will say that if you go and you get your blood work done on a pretty regular basis, as I do love the fact that I can actually pull up my results from LabCorp and actually look at it long before I go to see the doctor. So I've been doing that, I don't know, the last year or so, being able to pull it up, take a look, you know, hey, what's my blood sugar? What's my A1C? How am I doing from a B12 perspective? Oh, I'm a little deficient on my vitamin D. Before I even go and see the doctor, I'm looking at those results, Googling things, trying to get some context of how my numbers look. It's kind of a neat thing. I really hope that if there's one area that I'd like to see them really shine in, it would be to take that data and make it so that I can get access to it, because that does seem to be a useful thing. Also, I pay closer attention to how much I move because of the Apple Watch and the statistics. And I thought about turning those off at one point. I'm like, no, yeah, it's good to know that I've moved this amount today, or I've done this amount today. So
metrics are king.
I really am a data nerd. So I really do pay attention to that stuff, probably far too much. I do sweat the details quite a bit. Well, it looks like we're just coming up on an hour now, so I guess this is a good place to stop. So next week, no Brian. There will be only Jim and Brad, and I look forward to listening to this as someone who doesn't participate in it, just to see what that's like.
That's a fun spin on it.
Yeah, it'll still be pretty cool. So as always, it's been a pleasure talking to you, Brad. You have yourself a good week, sir.
Good night.